Welcome to Season 6 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are continuing our journey of broadening our knowledge in the field of combat sports science by speaking to experts in the fields of nutrition science, psychology, strength and conditioning, and much more to help you become the best practitioner you can be. Today, our guest on the podcast is Dr. James Moran. James is a performance nutritionist with a Bachelor in Sport and Exercise Science, Masters of Science in Sports Physiology, and a PhD in Sports Nutrition. He is also the founder and owner of Moran Performance and currently works as the Head of Performance Nutrition with the Bristol Bears Rugby Club. James is a returning guest to the show, and today we are going to be talking about a brand new paper that he released where he assessed the weight cycling habits of a professional boxer over a 5-year time period. This is such an interesting listen, as this is something we see quite often on the ground as practitioners, but don't get the chance to read about a lot in the research. There's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. All right, back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Been a little while between drinks for this one, but what an episode to bring it back in. We've got Dr. James Moran joining us for the second time. It's been a while since we spoke, James. What was it? Probably, I'd say 18 months getting up there now.
Yeah, it's around that, isn't it? Too long, mate. Too long, but yeah, we can get going again.
Far too long. How's everything been? Obviously, there's been some pretty big events happening in the world, but how's everything been going for you the last little while?
Yeah, not bad. It's been difficult, isn't it, for everyone worldwide? But I think certainly here in the UK, we're beginning to come out the back of it. Providing we can get some petrol in the engines, then I think everyone's happy at the moment. I've recently left England football and got myself back into professional rugby union. So I'm now heading up the nutrition at Bristol Bears, and then just driving my own business on the outside of that as well. So all good apart from that.
I was going to say, you must have been keeping yourself pretty busy during those COVID times, eh?
Yeah, I think we all had to, didn't we? One of the first things I did, moved into the new home and converted the garage into a gym straight away. Then got a dog, which probably half the world got a puppy at the same time. So I think those two things, yeah, kept me sane. And obviously, you know, people had a lot more time to think about other projects that they might want to do or little things that they want to work on. And one of those for me was writing a book, which has been a long process, but we're nearing the final stages now before that gets published.
If this is sidetracked a little bit, because this is a really cool project. This is the book where you're going around and you're talking top level performance nutritionists, right? Is this the one we're talking about?
Yeah, correct. So this kind of stemmed off the back of me 6-7 years ago. And in terms of where I was in my career at the time. And then also speaking to younger or junior practitioners at the moment who are maybe just starting their masters in sport nutrition or sport dietetics, or they've just graduated, but they're struggling to get those jobs. And they're at a bit of a crossroads where they arguably they've got the academic knowledge, but that doesn't get them the interview, and it's not resulting in them with a successful job interview and then getting the job. So I just thought, look, this could be a cool project. So I've gone out and I've interviewed 10 what I would call successful performance nutritionists in their own right, researchers, academics, and then I've just asked them about their career journey, the lessons that they've learned throughout their career, what's been some of the biggest wins that they've had in their applied practice, what have been some of their biggest lessons that, you know, where they might have screwed up, but they really learned from that moment. And then importantly, what they think the future of performance nutrition looks like in 5 years time. And what advice would they give their younger self and be able to give other people? And then the final kind of golden question that I ask is, what do they think a successful performance nutritionist looks like? And it's really good because there's definitely some themes that are coming out from every interview. But what's nice is that no journey is the same. Everyone's had their own path and transition into the industry. And it's really good. I've thoroughly enjoyed interviewing the 10 people. I've learned something from every chapter, I guess. I genuinely believe this could help fill a bit of a gap in the literature in terms of there's lots of mechanistic and, you know, fundamental physiology textbooks and journals we can read. But this is really about, okay, now you've got that knowledge. what can you do to make yourself stand out from the crowd when you're trying to get that job in the industry? So yeah, cool project, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it will be out and ready to buy before Christmas.
Let's give a little bit of a plug here, because I think I've had that conversation probably at least a dozen times every week for the last 6 months with students coming through. And that's all they say, right? Like, they come out and they're like, I have all this knowledge, but what do I do with it? And like you said, knowledge isn't really that useful unless you have somewhere to apply it. Is there like a wait list or something? Is there, where can someone go and buy this? Because I'm sure all the, if you are listening to this and you are a student, you should definitely go and read this book, because this information would be vital. Where could they get it, James?
Yeah, so there's a link on my website to like a pre-order sign up. So we can definitely share that link. Or if people want to reach out to me on the social handles, more than happy to send them the link there. And I have gone global with it. So we've got Dr. Jill Leckie, who's part of the AIS, Australian cycling team. So she's on there. We've interviewed her. So we haven't just focused on UK football. We've kind of focused on different sports and different practitioners across the world.
How good. Anyway, let's get into it. So September 30th, so that's just gone over a month, released this paper, very, very cool paper in the International Journal of Sport Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism, a five-year analysis of weight cycling practices in a male world champion, professional boxer, potential implications for obesity and cardiometabolic disease. That's a mouthful for everyone following at home. Really, really cool paper though. Massive, massive contribution to the field, and something that I think when you're in the field, you realize that you see it in action. Hey, but this is so cool that you've put all this information together and slapped it down. Tell us, how did this even come to be? When did you think, okay, yeah, this is going to be a project that I want to work on?
Yeah, look, first and foremost, credit to Professor James Morton with this as well, because James used to work with Rocky Fielding in Liverpool, and then at a point in James's career where he was progressing very well, he kind of very kindly said to me, look, I'm struggling to take on the work with Rocky amongst everything else. It's not fair that I try and kind of shortcut him in a way. So would you be willing to work with him? And James could kind of oversee the project within Liverpool John Moores as well. So, you know, big thanks to James for passing Rocky over to me. And then essentially, you know, he even from the first camp, because I knew where Rocky was in his career, and I knew kind of where his ambitions were, and a bit of a vision and path as to where he was trying to get to, I just started collecting the data. But at the time, I'll be honest, I wasn't doing anything special. I was just, as a sports scientist, collecting data, which is surely what we should all be doing anyway. And so I kind of tracked him through that first camp. Was looking at the nutrition side of stuff, looking at the body composition, you know, getting him into the labs and doing his RMRs where we could. And then it really just built up a nice baseline for me to say, okay, well, this is what the first camp looked like. So if we're going to repeat what we did in the first camp, these are the kind of numbers that we need to stick to or tweak and refine and get better. And we just went through that process. So whenever Rocky had a scheduled fight, we would, you know, whenever that got announced, we would then work out, okay, we've got an 8-week camp or 10-week camp. Some of the camps dragged on because opponents pulled out and we had to find another opponent. But, you know, better than me, that's just the world of combat sports. We just monitored and tracked Rocky over the 5-year period. And I probably knew after about 3 years that, yeah, we've got some cool data here, because, you know, some of my own PhD studies in rugby was just a really acute snapshot. And like what you said, there wasn't too much in our industry looking at these longitudinal changes in something like body composition. We all see it. We all have worked with those combat sport athletes that make weight, they rebound, they then end their camp, and then they come back in 6 weeks later and they've put on 5 or 6 kilo. So we know that it happens, but kind of no one had ever looked at tracking that over time. So it was just being, I guess, a due diligence sports scientist at the time and collecting the data.
Yeah, it definitely paid off. Let's break it down and let's go through each part. And what exactly were you tracking when you got word and Rocky goes, hey, James, I'm going back into camp? What were the initial things that you were, or data points that you were collecting when you got that call?
Yeah, so the first thing that we would try and do is just get him into the lab and almost do a bit of a baseline testing block, I guess. So, and this didn't happen every camp, but where possible, we tried to make it happen. So it would have been like a VO2 max on the treadmill with a fat max exercise. But that, like I said, that didn't happen in every camp. So we decided not to put that data in. We would then do baseline body composition with the DEXA. And then we would do in the gym, if where possible, we would get some bit of kit like the Gym Aware, and we would look at doing some force velocity profiling, because the aim of the game with that in particular was, yes, he's going to start dropping weight, but where possible, we don't want to start dropping force and the ability for the boxer to produce power as his weight is coming down. So we were tracking that over the course of the camp as well. When you write up a case study, you are limited on the word count. And so there's only so much you can put in there. So with this, we decided to focus more on the body composition change and manipulation over time rather than the S&C side of stuff. And that's why there's not a lot of detail in terms of like the physical training that he did. And then, yeah, so we do that baseline assessment. Included in there was a resting metabolic rate off the metabolic cart when we had access to it or when Rocky could make it in. And then we would just track it over time. And if it was like an 8-week camp, we would get him in at week one, potentially at week four, and then maybe week seven, kind of the start of the acute weight loss, because we were trying to minimize kind of any implication of that acute weight loss on the DEXA scan measurement. And then we'd just repeat it, go again. And there were, I mean, I know you'll have the paper up there as well, but there were periods where, for whatever reason, we couldn't get Rocky into the lab. And so we didn't have those starting DEXA scans. So contest 2 and 3 and 4 on the paper, we kind of had a window there of missing data, but we had the data from contest 1. So we decided to put that in. And then, yeah, we just go through and repeat it over time. Of course, being a nutritionist, there was guidance there on what Rocky needed to eat at the start of the camp. And kind of we would manipulate that the further as he went through the camp. And then he would follow, you know, the classic acute weight loss methods and strategies in that final 5-day period. But again, we just, because of word count, we could only really give an example template of what nutrition may have looked like. Hopefully that gives a bit of background as to what we were doing and collecting.
And how many camps did you end up getting in with this, James?
So overall, we did 11 contests. So I guess you could call that 11 camps back to back over that 5-year period. I'm just trying to think, were there more than that? There may have been one or two extra in there, but they would have been kind of the classic warm-up fights, less, you know, a little bit of ring rust, let's get him in and have a 6-8 rounder or whatever. But apart from that, yeah, they were all legit kind of, you know, professional bouts. And one of them was a world title win in Germany. And then one of them was his the win of the British and the Commonwealth title, the world title win in Germany against Tyrone Zoyga, and then his defense of his world title, which was a legit Rocky story in Madison Square Garden against Canelo.
So let's have a look at this and let's go through the data here. And there's a few questions we'll dig deep in, because I appreciate whenever I get you guys on, you read the paper and the paper's really cool, but I always know that there's more data in there you can discuss. But the big take-home messages that we got here and the big thing that stands out to anyone that reads it is the weight cycling. Can you talk to us? What was happening to his weight in between all of these camps?
Yeah, so Rocky is about 6'2", and obviously at super middleweight was weighing in at 76.2 kilo. Now, to put it in perspective, I'm 5'6", and I weigh 75 kilo. So, you know, it always amazed me looking at him thinking, you know, it's crazy that you actually make this weight and you get yourself down to it. Similar to Callum Smith, who's another Liverpool-based boxer, you know, super lean, super tall. But yeah, so he would, depending on kind of what he'd done in his time out of the camp, that would then result in his starting body weight, which, as you'll see from the table, really fluctuated quite a bit. So, you know, between 2 kilos, sometimes a little bit more of a fluctuation, but that would really be dependent on what he did. So that if we just dive a little bit deep into contest six, so the starting weight at contest six was 93.2 kilo. Now, bearing in mind, Rocky weighs in at 76.2. We had 11 weeks to take 17 kilos off of him. And why did he come in at that starting body weight? It's because, quite simply, he lived a normal life and went to Thailand and had a holiday and inevitably was eating quite well, having a few beers and just enjoying himself. So, you know, he wasn't going to step on scales on a 2-week holiday when he was away. But the reality was, when he came home, he was well over where he should be. And the fight got signed. He's not going to turn down the fight. And so we had to walk through it. And I actually remember the day that he told me his weight, and then I worked out how many weeks we had. I remember sitting down with James Morton and at that point as a practitioner thinking, is this right? And is this doable to support an athlete to lose 17 kilos in 11 weeks? And I remember speaking to James about, like, physiologically, like, is it possible? And James, I'll never forget it. He said, we've got to be careful and we've got to do the right thing. But the reality is, he's going to make the weight anyway. He's going to do it whether you want to support him or not. And so I decided there and then that it would have been a little bit wrong for me to know that he was going to try and make that weight on his own and just turn my back on him, so to speak. So decided to support him through it. And we got there in the end. But then, yeah, in between those fights, obviously he would come down to that 76.2, would follow all of the evidence-based literature around that acute weight loss. And then he was going back into the ring at around kind of 76.2 weighing in, going back into the ring between 80 and 82 kilos. And then he would do that fight. And then off the back of the fight, we would then have the classic energy expenditure would drop because he's now not in a camp. He's not training triple days. Energy intake would increase a little bit because he now wants to go and have a little bit of birthday cake with his son, or he wants to take his daughter out for dinner. And of course, we've then got that swing in the other direction. And so that weight would just increase slightly. And that's where we were seeing that weight cycling over time, which we all see in practice anyway. And then that's where we began to dig a little bit deeper into this kind of whole area of collateral fattening, so to speak.
Before we get into the changes that you saw in his body composition between them, one question: when Rocky went back into it, you said, so he's coming down from all these different weights and they're not crazy, but they are pretty different. Was his weight when he went back into the ring relatively similar between these camps when he reloaded after weigh-ins?
Yeah. So that's one thing that was quite consistent. Where I really interrogated the numbers was the fight against Canelo and the previous fight where he won his world title against Tyrone Zoyga. So I was literally there with the notepad almost every time I could get him near a scale. I was saying, can you just step on? I want to see what you're at. So I've got the data on that. We didn't put it in because we didn't want to kind of cloud that table. But we did show the data for the Canelo fight at the end there, that acute weight loss and rebound up. But yeah, it was between 80 and 82 kilo for most fights he would consistently come back in the ring at. So, and when you talk to like the normal person or even the rugby players now, you know, 6 kilo swing, they're like, what? How does that happen? Like, what is it? But, you know better than me that simply it was we were rehydrating the athlete. We were putting a lot of carbohydrates and glycogen back into the muscle. And the guy had food weight back in his body as well. And so the 6 kilo swing, it sounds a lot. But really, once you add in 3-4 liters of water over a 24, 48 hour period, like it's not massive, really, which you'll know better than me anyway. So yeah, he consistently went in between that bracket, mate, 80 and 82.
And what about entering the fight week? Even with the discrepancies between the weights, was Rocky generally entering the fight week at his normal fight week weight?
Yeah, he was. I'm just going to pull this up as we're talking, but he he would always, one thing that I was really aware of was the kind of literature talking about this 5 to 8% in that final kind of acute weight loss window. And so where possible, you know, I was trying to aim for him to be in and around that. One thing that you'll be fully aware of as well was that, and it was an education piece for me, but speaking to Jamie, his trainer, that Jamie never wanted him to go lighter. For his last spar, before he would then have a deload before the fight, Jamie never wanted him below what he would go in the ring at. So we knew that he would go in the ring at between 80 and 82. And so that last spar, Jamie always wanted him between 80 and 82. It might be 82 if it's a kind of heavier opponent, might be 80 if it's someone that they've targeted. But so the aim of the game there was to always keep Rocky at his fighting weight for his last spar, which then, depending on when that last spar was, you know, 10 days beforehand, 7 days, 12 days, that would then kind of decide the amount of weight that we had to shift in that final 10, 12 or 8 day period. But normally we would always try and hit the Monday of fight week in and around that weight that we wanted him at, so that he could then pull that off in that final, what, 4.5, 5 day window.
And I ask because I always find it, I feel like if it was a random person, not a trained nutritionist like yourself, not crunching the numbers, it would seem incredible. But these guys, even when they come out, it's almost like to the untrained eye, their body just knows, right? They know how to get down to that weight and they'll get down there, right? And obviously you're programming what they're going to eat, but they have that number in their mind. I know I need to hit this number coming into fight week, and they're going to hit it.
No, that's it. That's it. And look, I'm not a fighter. I've never been a boxer or anything like that. So when I first started with Rocky, it was also chatting to him about, you know, where is it you want to be? What is it you want to present at in that final week? Like, how have you best made weight before? And when did you feel like you were at your best? And what was really nice was that when we went over to Germany against Zoiga, everything kind of fell into place and helped me out that week, because it was a July fight in Germany. So it was about 30 degrees. We had a really hot week over there. And so even us walking around getting coffees, we were hot, we were sweating. So I knew that, you know, to get a kilo off of Rocky, or it was actually about 2.2 kilo the morning of the weigh-in, I knew that we could go for a 30-minute slow run together and I'd probably lose 1.5 kilos myself, let alone him, who was a quick sweater, he was a fast sweater. So the weather was amazing for us. And then we had a delayed weigh-in. Normally he would weigh in at 12 or 1 o'clock, but for whatever reason, they scheduled it at 3. So we had that extra 2 hours on that day. And, you know, we don't need to start bringing out the water on a Monday, like, and dehydrating then. We could simply go for a run Friday morning around the block, do a bit of skipping in the courtyard, and he'd made the weight, no problem. And it was just normal sweating, like any other team sport athlete would do during a game.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, eh? And that's the best way to think about it. And if there's young practitioners who are listening, I think it is important to note that, because I think it almost gets glorified, right? Like where, oh, I've got to go in a sauna, or I've got to go in a bath, and I've got to do this. But it's something I've noticed a lot in my practice lately, and especially in the last, say, 12 months or so, a lot of the top level guys don't do it. They're just like, nah, they'd rather do exactly what you just described. I'd rather go for a bit of a run just outside and skip and play basketball with the guys. And that's how I make weight. It's like none of them, I've never heard someone say to me, hey, yeah, man, I'm really looking forward to sitting in this sauna for 2 hours and sweating and being in horrible pain.
yeah, exactly.
What did you find, James? What did you find with these metabolic markers? If we're going into here in between camps, what was happening to Rocky's body when he was fluctuating? He was going up and down. What did you find?
Yeah, so obviously with the, like, starting the camp, Rocky would present with X amount of lean mass, X amount of fat mass. The aim of the game was to try and pull down fat mass as best as possible whilst maintaining or minimizing the amount of fat-free mass that was coming off on that DEXA. Now, in most of our camps, we had to lose, of course, we were pulling down the fat mass, but we also had to drop the fat-free mass as well. Now, where possible, we were trying to keep him not in a catabolic state. So protein was nice and high, but the reality was that he was you know, triple training day. He was expending some serious calories and just fundamentally wasn't consuming enough to try and look after the lean tissue. So we tried to catch the amount of fat-free mass or muscle mass that he was dropping in his camps, but it almost had to come off because of the amount of weight that the guy had to lose. Could he have lost more fat mass in each camp? Like, yeah, he could have done, but I think, you know, it's just the reality of working with an athlete that's also got two kids at home and a missus, and that there's those demands on him as well. Did he nail every single morning run in a 12-week camp? No, he didn't, because there was occasions where something might have happened. He had to take the child to nursery or whatever. So could fat mass have been lower? It could have been. But we also had to drop that fat-free mass or lean tissue mass, which we didn't want to do. But it was just a reality of him trying to make that actual fighting weight. So the lean mass would drop as well. Body fat percentage would drop, of course, as the guy was becoming leaner, it kind of in towards that final weigh-in. But then what we did see, and this was where it got really interesting, kind of dissecting this and discussing this data with both James and Carl, was looking at how he was then presenting at the following camp. So what was his starting position again at the following camp? And this is where we kind of discovered or were interrogating the data and looking at this potential collateral fattening, which essentially what they're talking about, and I'll try and explain this to the best of my ability, is that when an individual is losing weight and they're dropping body mass, of course, we're trying to drop body fat and we're trying to not drop lean tissue. But in this instance, what was happening was both of them were dropping. So if you imagine like that DJ slider deck, like both of them were like dropping down to volume zero. And then what was happening once Rocky had finished the fight, because energy balance went positive, because energy expenditure had dropped and he started living like a normal person again, the accumulation of the fat mass, so the volume marker on fat mass, was increasing far quicker than the lean mass, the ability for the body to accumulate muscle mass again. And so what happened was that every camp that was going on, his fat mass was rising a little bit more before his kind of lean muscle mass went back to like where his baseline level was again. And so in the literature and in the papers that we reference, that's where they talk about this collateral fattening, that if you then repeat that time and time and time and time again, then that's where it can potentially lead to some of these cardiometabolic diseases later on in life. And I think over here in the UK, there's one of our probably most well-known boxers who retired or in his career was doing this pretty drastically, was Ricky Hatton. And now the Mancunian has retired, you know, he is overweight. He is probably classed as clinically obese. You know, he's nowhere near to the body composition that he had as a fighter, which probably shows that it's not maintainable for someone to stay in that physique, but also this weight cycling over time. And, you know, we will all know those athletes that do the weight cycling and then end their career and they just start accumulating the weight. And it's really interesting to look at some of those fighters, that someone like Canelo, who arguably doesn't have to cut weight in his camps. He can just maintain in and around where he is. He hasn't got to go through these weight cycles. Someone like Mayweather that never really did it. And then you look at them when they've retired and they've kind of stayed the same weight and they're in and around the same body composition. That's what we were starting to see on the data, and that's where we started to kind of stimulate this discussion about weight cycling.
James, did you guys collect any of the metabolic data? Did you collect any bloods during this?
We didn't. No, unfortunately not. We would have loved to, but we just didn't get with everything going on and the kind of access to Rocky. Yeah, we didn't get that. We were measuring resting metabolic rate. We had a handful of kind of measured resting metabolic rate and then predictive. And what was interesting there was that kind of the RMR wasn't really changing too much. So it doesn't really give us a great indication of kind of anything related there to the weight cycling. But I'm confident that if we were to collect some of the bloods, we would have seen some stuff going on. But yeah, we just access to the boxer in the morning, kind of DEXA and RMR, and then getting him in the gym was like the main focus.
I was going to say, you're already probably pushing the envelope a little bit of what you're asking for with everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I just remember, like, there was once with Rocky where, you know, we had him on a scheduled DEXA and then a morning run all in the gym together. And, you know, the text come through, lads, I can't make it. Like, Ralphie's poorly. And it's just a stark reminder that, like, his young boy was ill and he had to stay at home and he couldn't make it in. So, you know, we can kick up a fuss and say, oh, yeah, but that was a key data collection point. The reality is he's still a bloke who's got kids at home and he's still living a normal life.
Yeah, I think people forget, hey, like, top-level athletes or even athletes in general, they're still humans, right? They're still humans. They still have families. They've still got commitments. Let's say you did collect the bloods, James. Do you have any theories about what you might have seen throughout the camp, or more specifically in between these weight cycling periods? Do you have any idea of what might have been going on with it?
It's a really interesting one, because if we had collected the data and the bloods from Rocky, would we have seen a difference? Like, I don't know. I don't know, because it's when he was out of a camp and he was then living like a normal bloke again, you know, you're almost reverting back to just like being a normal human being. And so I think the blood collection would have been, depending on the timings when we would have done it, you know, there may have been some shifts in some of the markers. But when I think about, I'm digressing a little bit here, but when I look at my partner, she's doing her PhD in female physique athletes who, you know, put themselves on stage and go through that bout of leanness and body composition, aesthetic ideal. And what she's found with her bloods is that actually there's no difference. There's no difference in the starting blood profile and then getting on the stage and competing. And what I've discussed previously with some of the practitioners is looking at kind of your physique athlete bodybuilding world, who they do this kind of really, really, really tight nutritional intake for kind of 5 or 6 days. And then they have that one day there where they kind of reverse it and they just eat like a normal person would. They're not necessarily a cheat day, but they just eat normal again, and they kind of reverse that pattern of being really strict during the week. And does that keep them in a normal homeostatic or stasis profile in terms of body composition, mental state, psychological well-being? And I always wonder whether, and I don't know this at all, but I always wonder whether, you know, during those weeks, as much as there was nutritional plans for Rocky to consume, was there a little bit of deviation outside of that during the camps? But then, of course, I think there was deviation outside of it in between camps, because the body composition was changing a little bit. But no, we didn't kind of, yeah, we didn't collect it. We ideally should have done, but it's something that we just didn't get around to.
Because this is a common theme, and I guess myself and Carl, we've discussed this quite a lot, right? And you mentioned it before with guys like Canelo and Mayweather, and you're talking about the change in this energy balance, and within that energy balance equation, the fat-free mass is really important, right? And you see this, and you see this with these guys when they have these huge rebound hyperphagic response, that energy balance, the state of energy balance that they're in, or energy availability that they're in, is far lower than what they should be technically by the literature that we have now. And like Carl talks about, there probably is a degree of resilience, right? There's probably a degree of resilience that the body has to this. And potentially that's maybe what your partner's seeing in her physique athletes. There's that resilience to it. Do you think that, say, if there's athletes that aren't going to do these drastic cuts, then they're not going to go, hey, I'm at this weight and I'm going to push my body to the absolute limit to get down, and by doing so, going in these crazy states of low energy availability, are they almost protecting themselves a bit against this weight cycling effect or this collateral fattening, do you think?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, mate. What's really interesting is that I work at the moment with another boxer, Chris Billum-Smith, who's in the Commonwealth category. And Chris's most weight that he ever fluctuates in a camp really is about 8 kilos. And that's with a combined 3 or 4 kilo acute weight loss. So really, he's only ever fluctuating like 5 or 6 kilos in a camp, which is nowhere near as drastic as like a 17 kilo swing. And what's really nice with Chris is that when he's outside of a camp, he's still in great shape. And he's still, you know, at any time point, if he got a call and said, could you fight in 3 weeks' time, he'd probably be absolutely fine to do that. So from a psychological and mental well-being phase, I would confidently say that because he's not weight cycling nowhere near as much, like the amplitude of the peaks and troughs is far more depressed. Like, you know, that surely that has to, you know, work in his favor. And even things like, I know obviously Cole published the data and looked at something like testosterone when they're right in that final kind of phase of making weight. Like, I'd confidently say that Chris's testosterone levels are still firing, and he's not going to be as low as what the mixed martial art athlete that Cole's shown. If we collected like the testosterone with Rocky during some of those final cuts, you know, I'd probably say they would have been on par, maybe not as extreme as what Cole presented or published, but they would have been on par with that just because of the amount of that weight cycling that had happened. But yeah, I think there has to be the body's ability to be able to offset some of those negative consequences of the markers. You know, has Chris ever experienced renal damage? Definitely not, because you speak to him on the day of the weigh-in and he's like a normal bloke, he's absolutely fine. But when you look at the markers of kidney damage that Cole shows, like that's not a good kind of sign, is it? No, that's not a sign. And again, like if we collected that with Rocky, would there have been elements of that? Like, I don't know. Maybe we were beginning to move that direction, but what Rocky didn't do is it was nowhere near as extreme in that final 48 hours. But yeah, I think, look, this is probably a shout out to anyone that's working with those athletes that are not doing the weight cycles. Wouldn't it be really cool to have a look at those longitudinal body compositions of athletes that are just sticking at their weight and they're not jumping around? And yeah, let's start kind of collecting the blood. Certainly it's something that I'm trying to push now with Chris. It's just access to money and funding to allow it all to happen.
yeah, absolutely. James, I know this next part I'm going to ask you about, I know you guys didn't publish it, and even if it is anecdotal from your conversations with the strength conditioning coach or just what you noticed with Rocky, you said you were doing some force velocity testing through there. Did you notice throughout the camps or between these camps, say when Rocky did that big 17 kg swing, did you notice more drastic downpours of his strength and, you know, he really dropped off because of that weight loss compared to other camps where the weight loss wasn't as severe?
Yeah, what we were seeing was that from like the beginning of a camp to like the midway of a camp, there was like no difference between it or maintaining it / going up a little bit, because he was becoming fitter. He was becoming stronger because he'd just done a bout of like 4-6 weeks of lifting. So it made sense. And the impact of the body composition change might have only been, or it would have been more fat mass and maybe a smidgen of lean mass. But it was then in that final phase where energy intake was starting to reduce a little bit more. The training was going up because there were like the extra spars coming in, et cetera, et cetera. It's getting closer to the fight. And it was then where we were beginning to see, not drastic, but there was, you know, a bit of a drop off between the force velocity profiles. And we did it on not directly related to kind of boxing performance, I guess, but it was just a marker in the gym. We did it on bench, jump squats and back pulls. So we were just trying to assess those three main movements. What did that look like there? So it was from the start to the middle, I would say we were pretty similar, but from the middle to the end, to the final data checkpoint, that's where it was starting to drop off a little bit. We didn't collect at every camp, but the camps that we did collect it on, that was where we were beginning to see that drop off. And again, I think, you know, it was just lack of energy because we were trying to focus on the weight coming down, and long camp some of the camps were 14 weeks, 12 weeks, long amount of training. Like, you could argue he should be fitter and stronger, but as we know, if you're not putting the correct nutrition in and the muscle mass is starting to drop off, it would make sense that the force is starting to drop a little bit. But it was nothing drastic that we wanted to like put in the paper and write about.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm very mindful of your time. So the very last question I want to ask you is, what do you think the implications are of this type of research?
Yeah, nice. Hopefully it motivates and drives others to collect similar. What you've got to remember is that this was one person. This was one boxer in the UK in one weight division. I know Carl's driving loads of great research with his combat sport athletes now. Keep an eye on that stuff, because he's got some really cool things that are coming out. But hopefully it would really drive people to look at their N of one and think, you know what, if I can really collect some good, robust, consistent data time after time, we'll have a really good insight into what some of these professionals look like. And, you know, Trent Stellingworth has done a great longitudinal study on his wife, actually, who's a Canadian Olympic long distance runner, and looked at, I think in her period, she was actually pregnant as well. So she's got like multiple year period where they had to increase energy availability to allow them to become pregnant, or her to become pregnant, have the baby, then come back into training. And like, that's golden data. Like, that's amazing to read and amazing to see. And she's an Olympic level athlete. So yeah, I think the implications of this would be in particular to the weight cycling, a bit of an eye opener for those practitioners that are working with athletes that are real fluctuating their weight. And probably a question to us all to say, is this something that we want to support, these massive weight fluctuations? Or as a collective, do we try and educate these athletes to bring the amplitude of those peaks and troughs, like I said earlier, a little bit more depressed, so that we don't see Aspen Ladd last week again on the scales struggling to make the weight. I think that's the fourth video I've seen of Aspen in that situation where she's really struggling and visibly shaking. Like, at what point does the practitioner or the athlete think, actually, I'll try and make the weight a little bit better, I'll give myself a bit of a longer time to do it? So yeah, hopefully that's that kind of is a bit of a push for the right direction for the people that are working in combat sport athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more. And I think, at least anecdotally from our practice with the athletes we work with, I think you're spot on. I think you're absolutely spot on. I find with the guys we have, it's the ones that just sit a few percent above their fight week weight, they're always in good shape. We never struggle to make weight. They get on. In our team, we say, if you send someone on the weight and they look like they've done a big weight cut, they may as well miss. They may as well miss. I count that as a miss. Like, you don't want them going on there looking unhealthy. And the guys that look the most plump, the most healthy, that are smiling and laughing on the scale, they're the guys that don't cut a lot of weight. And it's probably, and you see that in between camp, you don't see these crazy fluctuations. They can train all year round. They can get a call and say, hey, yeah, I'll fight in Abu Dhabi in 4 weeks' time. That's fine. Like, because they manage their weight fine.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's a saying, isn't there, like, a happy fighter is a dangerous fighter and all of that sort of stuff. But, you know, I think if you were to run some of the classic psychometric assessments and the Brum's mood scale and things like that, is there a correlation between a fighter that has managed to make his weight really easily? I don't know how we define really easily, but in a happy medium place, versus someone that's struggled. They know they've struggled. They've had a poor night's sleep the night before because they're worrying about the weight. They're stressed out. Is there a correlation between that? I don't know. I know Reed has spoke about before the lack of correlation between the amount of weight regained and the outcome of a fight. But for me, yeah, if you've got a fighter that can go through that camp with kind of minimal acute kidney damage, you know, they're not showing any signs of psychological distress. You've got testosterone levels that are not reduced and, you know, fighting fit where they should be, then surely that is all those one percenters that will drive in the right direction to help that fighter should it go 12 rounds? And you know, those little things might add up and count.
Yeah, that's a conversation I've been having a lot lately, actually, is maybe back in the day, you know what, maybe back in the day, and especially a sport like MMA, it's so new, right? And then even boxing's an old sport, but the science behind boxing is not new at all. I think nowadays there's probably a lot other 1% as you can do to get that advantage by the time you come in the cage or ring or on the mats or whatever, that probably supersede the 1% that you're going to get from doing these big weight cuts. Maybe way back in the day when we didn't have good strength conditioning, we didn't have, you know, mental coaches, breath work, whatever, good trainers, maybe doing a big weight cut, maybe that did give you a benefit, but I don't think so. Not in 2021. But anyway, James, I'm super conscious of your time. If guys listening to this, they want to learn more about the paper, they want to learn more about the book and where they can get their hands on. If there's students listening to this, I highly encourage you to do that. Where can they find all that info?
Yeah, so I'm on the social handles, Twitter, James Moorhen. So not to be confused with Morton, because he is leaps and bounds above where I am. James Moorhen. My Instagram is Moorhen Performance. And then the website, moorhenperformance.com. And there's a link there to kind of the sign up for the book as well. And I'll pass you the link and you can add that into show notes or whatever you want to do with it there as well. But yeah, look, I think just as you are, mate, very passionate about the area. I enjoy helping athletes, you know, get ready for competition, whether that's team sport, boxers, whatever. So always keen to discuss and jump on the phone with anyone that wants to have a bit of a chin wag around the area.
Yeah, and take James up on that, because one of the best to do it in that part of the world, works with some of the best guys, part of some of the best teams. And we're just talking about how I feel the teams you guys have, like James Morton, Carl Langen Evans, all the guys that are around that educated you essentially, I think are probably the best to do it in this field, and just passing on their knowledge to you that can go to you, whoever's listening to this. But anyway, James, I'll let you get back to it and start your day, but thanks so much, mate, for coming on again.
All good, no problems, mate. Speak to you soon.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. What an insightful paper from James, and credit to him for collecting the data over 5 years of working with Rocky Fielding, as he was one of the best boxers on the scene at the time. I highly encourage you to read the full article and also follow James on his socials and keep an eye out for his new book. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.